Care Talk with Laura Packard is a podcast covering healthcare in America from a progressive perspective. Our healthcare system is broken, and we all know insurance companies are out of control. If you don't have health insurance or don't understand the differences between insurance plans or have surprise medical bills, out-of-control prescription drug costs, or can't get the care you need, listen to Care Talk with Laura Packard weekly on Tuesdays. What's going to happen to your healthcare under the Trump administration? From prescription drug prices to health insurance costs, from healthcare for seniors and people with disabilities to reproductive care, from care for veterans to public health, including vaccinations. Healthcare experts answer your questions every week, and they go in-depth on Medicare, Medicaid, the Affordable Care Act, private insurance, and more. Go to healthcarevoices.org/caretalk or search for Care Talk with Laura Packard on your favorite podcast app to listen today.
MSW Media.
Spy Talk, a podcast at the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, national security, and military operations.
Hi, I'm Michael Isikoff, and this is Spy Talk.
Two questions related to each other. First, you said on your first day of office, you're going to pardon January 6th defendants. Are you planning to pardon those who were charged with violent offenses?
Well, we're looking at it, and we have other people in there. And as you see, I guess 24 or 28 people came now from the FBI. That came out very quietly. Nobody reported it, but they had people in some form related to the FBI. They had four or five people that were strongly related to the FBI. We have to find out about that. We have to find out about Hezbollah. We have to find out about who exactly was in that whole thing, because people that did some bad things were not prosecuted. You know, I see it all the time, and you see it too. People that were doing some bad things weren't prosecuted, and people that didn't even walk into the building are in jail right now. So we'll be looking at the whole thing, but I'll be making major pardons. Yes, please.
That was President Trump this week, once again vowing major pardons of those convicted of storming the Capitol on January 6, 2021, in an effort to disrupt the counting of electoral votes, certifying Joe Biden's election as president. Just how many of the nearly 1,000 individuals who have been convicted of crimes related to January 6 Trump will pardon remains unclear. But Trump's comments are only one piece of a significant shift in public attitudes about what for many Americans remains one of the darkest days in the nation's history. Where much in the country, including many Republicans at the time, saw January 6 as a shocking threat to democracy, those views have softened with the passage of time. One recent poll by The Economist and YouGov found that among political independents, the percentage of those who strongly disapproved of the actions of the rioters had dropped from 67% 4 years ago to only 50% today. The Washington Post, in an article this week, suggested the emerging public view about January 6 is moving towards meh. What explains this shift in public attitudes, and what does it say about the state of our politics? Nobody has a better perspective on the events of January 6 than Tim Hafey. A former U.S. attorney in the Western District of Virginia, Hafey served as chief counsel of the January 6 committee that conducted months of gripping hearings on the events of that day and a massive report urging that Trump himself be criminally prosecuted. Hafey has now written a book, Harbingers, about his time with the January 6 committee and the parallels he finds to a previous investigation he spearheaded into the rally of white supremacists in Charlottesville, Virginia in 2017. Hafey has important observations about what these two events mean and what is fueling a domestic terrorist threat still facing the country. He joins me now on Spy Talk. Tim Hafey, welcome to Spy Talk.
Thanks, Mike. Thanks for having me.
Sure. Congrats on the book. And there's lots in it that I want to talk to you about. But I have to start out with the President-elect Trump's comments the other day in his press conference, vowing major pardons for the January 6 rioters and even making some wild claims. There were no guns at the events of January 6, even including the idea that Hezbollah terrorists might have been involved, something we hadn't heard before. Give me your reaction and thoughts when you heard Trump's comments.
just crazy town, Michael. I don't understand it. It struck me as very similar to what we heard throughout the run-up to January 6th with the big lie. Just completely unfounded allegations about election fraud have become completely unfounded allegations about what happened at the Capitol. There's absolutely no evidence that Hezbollah or any foreign terrorist organization was involved. There were lots of guns found. Ashley Babbitt was not a peaceful protester. She was breaking through into the speaker's lobby when she was shot. Not to glorify that, but to sort of paint her as this peaceful protester is just a false narrative. So it's in the continuation of the president-elect's falsehoods about many subjects, and it's really discouraging.
I mean, the really striking thing is these comments and similar ones from many House Republicans and his MAGA allies do seem to have had an impact on public perceptions of January 6th. You know, there's some polling suggesting the percentage of Americans who now strongly disapprove of what happened on January 6th has dropped. I mean, among political independents, it's now only 50%. I mean, a lot of your book is, you know, an attempt to explain not only what happened on January 6th, but how these kinds of false narratives get traction.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Like the fact that these lies can gain currency, to me, reflects the sort of underlying cynicism that a lot of people have in this country about our institutions, and the big ones being government and media, right? Things that you and I take for granted as uncontroverted facts. We saw with our own eyes the violence of the Capitol. Other people don't trust the messenger. They didn't trust the select committee on which I worked. They think that they are somehow being misled by reporters like you, that all of that we take as, well, how could anyone dispute this? They question the credibility of the messenger. That is the undercurrent, that distrust in institutions that is much more creating a divide in this country than sort of a left-right dynamic, which we had some years ago.
You know, I have to say, you take a very sort of dispassionate and analytical approach to trying to explain this. I mean, it's not in reading the book. It's not written with anger. It's not written as a polemic in any way. I mean, you try to be, analytic in dissecting how it is that not only that, as I said, these events took place, but how the public has perceived them.
I think that's my training as a lawyer. I mean, look what I did in Charlottesville and in Jan 6 was a very similar approach. Let's just start with facts. Let's candidly tell the story of what happened there. That was the goal in Charlottesville. That was the goal with January 6th. And that's the goal in the book. It's not to be a polemic. It's not to be a call to action. It's meant more to be a dispassionate analysis of where I think we are as a country and as a democracy based on those things. That doesn't mean that the issues aren't worthy of a strong reaction, of anger, of all those things. I guess I still see my role more as someone who gathers and translates facts for a broader audience.
Since you brought up Charlottesville, which is a big part of the early of the book in the early sections, you should probably tell us a little bit. You had an interesting path to become the January 6th chief counsel. So just tell us a little bit about your background and how it is you came to have this rather significant role.
Yeah, sure. I appreciate that question. Look, lawyers become kind of accidental experts on things based on the matters on which they work. I live in Charlottesville. I was a U.S. attorney in Charlottesville. And after I left that position at the end of the Obama administration, the August 12th of 2017 happened. And as a resident of that community, I was horrified. And I wanted to be part of kind of the healing and the solution. So I reached out to the mayor and the city council, you know, who I knew, and said, look, you ought to do some sort of after action and some sort of assessment about what happened, what went right, What went wrong? And they hired me, me and my then law firm, to do that, to do an independent review. So I dove in and talked to people on all sides of that conflict, talked to cops, talked to politicians, talked to Unite the Right, you know, alt-right participants, to anti-racist counter-protesters. And I wrote this long critical report criticizing my own client, the city of Charlottesville, for how they mishandled the event. Speed forward, you know, 4 years of sitting in my office at UVA. I was the general counsel of UVA at this point on January 6th. The parallels were immediately obvious. This was a horrifically mismanaged event. And when the select committee was formed, law school classmate of mine, Sean Patrick Maloney, was in the House Democratic leadership. He connected me to the speaker and the staff that was putting together the Gen 6 committee team. And since I had this sort of accidental expertise about mass demonstrations and political violence from Charlottesville, I was hired as the chief investigative counsel for the January 6th committee. So I have these, you know, two seminal experiences looking at mass demonstrations that resulted in violence.
You mentioned that your report on Charlottesville did criticize the city's handling of that rally of white supremacists. What were the criticisms? What did you find that was the biggest one?
Yeah, there are a lot of things went wrong. One of the biggest ones was it was not an intelligence failure. It was an operational failure. There was lots of information in advance of August 12th suggesting that people were coming specifically to stoke violence, right? The narrative from the alt-right was, we're just there to exercise our free speech rights. But they were intentionally provocative by marching through a liberal college town chanting, you know, Jews will not replace us, with helmets and shields and spears, knowing that it would prompt a violent attack to sort of give them the ability to fight. And they just, for whatever reason, the police agencies, and it was the Charlottesville police, the Virginia State Police, just did not adequately assess that and prepare. They looked at it as a free speech event. They were standing behind bike racks. They just weren't prepared to protect the community. And that's why so much violence occurred. The other big failing was the elected officials. Instead of honestly sort of acknowledging that the First Amendment protects this speech and preparing people, briefing everyone as to what to expect, they tried to change it up to the very last minute. They were trying to either deny the permit or move the event outside of town, right? This was an event focused on Civil War statues, and the backdrop of the Robert E. Lee statue in Charlottesville was part and parcel of the speech of the event. So they essentially were challenged when they tried to cancel or move it, and they lost. And that happened the night before. So instead of kind of preparing the community for what to expect, they're trying to move the event, which was just a misguided decision in terms of the law. So there was no communication between the different agencies, no effective management of the event in real time. They thought all along it would descend into an unlawful assembly that they could disperse. So instead of trying to protect the speech, they created conditions that would allow them to shut it down. Yeah. Lots and lots of bad decisions at different levels.
By the way, one of the surprising things in your book, I'm sure this was reported at the time, but I didn't catch it or didn't remember it. The ACLU went to court to defend the right of the white supremacist protesters to have their rally at the Robert E. Lee statue.
Exactly right.
And you say they were right to do so.
They were right on the law. Absolutely. Look, a week before the event, the ACLU of Virginia filed in federal court a litigation seeking an injunction to prevent the rally from being moved away from the statue. They alleged correctly, as Judge Conrad in the Western District of Virginia found, that there was no imminent threat. There was no intelligence suggesting that the permit holders specifically intended to threaten or to create acts of violence, that there was a lot of danger, but it was not like we have a plan to do X. So there wasn't a basis to restrict speech. It's very hard for governments to restrict speech, no matter how hateful. That's bedrock First Amendment law. And the ACLU, you know, went to bat for them and won. And that's why the rally stayed in front of the statues.
Were there fine people on both sides?
Absolutely not.
As President Trump said at the time. Right.
We found in our investigation, very, very few people happened upon this event or were there really for the statues. I can't say there's a really careful accounting of everyone who was there, but mm-hmm. certainly all of the intelligence and all the people to whom we spoke said this was an organized effort, lots of people coming from around the country and some from Charlottesville who were there to sort of express their hateful message of white supremacy, who were there to provoke a strong backlash from all of the anti-racist counter-protesters. This notion that this was peaceful and that there were people that were just there to talk about the statues that had no expectation of violence. There may have been a handful of them in the crowd, but that was a very, very small minority.
Now, one of the points you make that was relevant to the Charlottesville rally and that carries over, and it's a parallel to January 6th, is the role of social media.
Yeah.
In allowing people of extreme political views to connect with each other and share thoughts, plans, and ideas they have to disrupt. Tell us a little bit about how significant that was in both Charlottesville and January 6th.
Very, very significant. It's one of the real commonalities between them. The advent of these social media platforms have allowed like-minded people with relatively extreme views to quickly find each other, to connect, to make plans to do things coming out of their basements, but into public view. It used to be much harder to do that. So the role of social media in quickly connecting and facilitating planning, very central to both events. The bigger issue though, Michael, that I flag in the book is that we found in both Charlottesville and at the Capitol that so many people who were there exclusively get their information from their curated social media feeds. The biggest example of this is a man named Stephen Ayers, who testified in one of the select committee hearings about January 6th. You know, here's a carpenter from Erie, Pennsylvania, Trump supporter, was surprised when the president lost the election. So he started reading about it on Facebook. And the only information he got came through his Facebook feed, which, as you know, is essentially designed to promote information to users based on their prior engagement with the platform. So he's getting information about election fraud, increasingly extreme and false, because of the curated feed that is going to him. He then gets connected to an affinity group of other people that believe the election was stolen. Then he's at the Ellipse to come for what he thought was a Trump rally. Then he's at the Capitol. Now, I don't mean to paint him as a victim, because he made a decision to only absorb that information, some of which was clearly inaccurate. But so many people in this country now get their information through links in these curated social media feeds. They're not looking at balanced sources that present both sides. They're only getting stuff through these platforms that are designed to keep their interest and therefore promote whatever they have initially engaged with. And that's not the social media platform's fault either. That's just a reality that we need to deal with. That is the information ecosystem in which we live.
And yet, just this week, we learn that Mark Zuckerberg, of the CEO of Meta, has removed fact checkers from Facebook and Instagram. We'll no longer have people who are going to do content moderation on what appears on these platforms.
Yeah, which again, that's a private company that is there to maximize value to shareholders. That's not illegal. You could argue it's not unethical. I wish it were different, but that is the company's prerogative. All the more reason for us collectively, to help people navigate the landscape, right? That what I talk a lot
well,
about.
Well, if Facebook is not going to do it, who's going
to
do it? And how does it get done? When you say we, how, in what way?
We, parents, we, teachers, we, schools, we. I would love to see more transparency so that we have the tools to understand how they work. I would love to see some restriction on sort of fake accounts, like bot accounts that sort of drive the algorithm dramatically. But we have to prepare, particularly our kids, Michael, to navigate this, to understand how this information is reaching them, to be educated consumers of the information, to do their own fact-checking if the platforms are not. And that's what I just don't think we're talking about enough. I mean, Jonathan Haidt's book, The Anxious Generation, talks a lot about this, right? We're sending our kids, we won't send them to the grocery store because we're worried about abduction, but we send them out onto the internet and use these platforms that are much more potentially dangerous. I think that's right. And we need to focus on how to help people understand this landscape.
You know, but some people listening to you on this, might scratch their head and say, look, these are broad societal problems that, need cultural shifts, to have the kind of changes you're talking about. And yet we have, a very clear domestic terrorist threat that is being fueled by this sort of activity. And, is there nothing that could be done legislatively or, by the government? If Facebook is not going to police what's on its content, who is?
And that's a slightly, I appreciate that question, but it's a slightly different one, right? What should law enforcement be doing with respect to their monitoring of content on these platforms? Another big part of my book is a common failure in Charlottesville on January 6th was the failure to operationalize primarily open source intelligence. There are a lot of reasons for that. One is that these agencies really don't share information effectively. We've got lots of different law enforcement agencies that are in silos and don't do a good job of aggregating and coordinating. I think the FBI puts undue restrictions on its own ability to respond to information that's open source.
That was significant in your book. You say that the FBI is too is too appreciative or too reluctant to monitor social media postings for fear of, violating civil liberties and people's privacies. And you're saying they're going too far in that direction.
Absolutely.
Now, there's real reasons why the FBI, for years they investigated, intimidated, surveilled political activists across the spectrums, and that there was a big pushback. I mean, from what J. Edgar Hoover did, that led to this reluctance,
or
in some cases, prohibitions on monitoring social
precisely.
Media.
Look, they have a terribly sordid history of essentially investigating people based on protected speech. That I'm not suggesting we throw that out or we disregard that. I just think the dial needs to be turned to a little bit more vigilance, because what happens is that the FBI cannot, under their own rules, and these are internal policies, not the Fourth Amendment or statutes, but the way that they have internally self-policed in the wake of these civil liberties problems, they take no action based on open source, protected speech, unless it is sufficiently specific and credible to justify opening a preliminary investigation. So let's say, for example, someone on Facebook posts a photograph carrying an AK-47 with the caption, January 6th is 1776, see you in Washington. That is not directly threatening. That is not very specific, not necessarily credible. It goes nowhere. It doesn't get aggregated. It doesn't get, no one goes and knocks on the door of that person and says, you posted this picture. What are your intentions? And I believe they therefore do not fully aggregate or appreciate patterns that emerge on these social media platforms. So I get it. It's not like you can just throw the doors open and give them carte blanche. I'd like to see them be a bit more proactive and lower that standard about what to do with information.
You want to see the FBI change its internal regulations on this?
I would like to see them, to turn the dial a little bit more, to give their agents the ability to do some proactive investigation based on things that they see on open source, without necessarily impacting free speech, but giving them the ability to lean forward and gather information more proactively.
You say without inhibiting free speech, but if the if something one posts on social media is going to lead to a knock on the door from an FBI agent, that could inhibit free speech, right?
Yeah, no question. There's a tension here, and I get that. But I think, given how they keep failing at operationalizing this intelligence, and we're experiencing these horrific acts of violence, I think it's time to reassess that policy. I really do.
Interesting. Well, look, this is a good time to take a break. And when we come back, we're going to talk to Tim about his experiences on the January 6th committee and some of the criticisms of how the committee conducted its business. And we're back with Tim Hafey. Tim, a lot of the controversy about the January 6th committee is how it was formed to begin with. Then Speaker Pelosi rejected two of the Republicans who the Republican leader, Kevin McCarthy, wanted to put on the panel, Jim Jordan and Jim Banks, because they were suspected of having communications with some of the rioters or being involved in some way. And when she did that, McCarthy then withdrew all Republicans. So the only two you had were selected by the Democrats, Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger. And look, I've covered congressional hearings, investigative hearings for years, Iran-Contra, 9/11, you know, and there's always a majority and a minority, which with the minority, you know, challenges the witnesses presented by the majority. You get different views. And look, you're a law enforcement guy. You're a former federal prosecutor. The premise of the criminal justice system is an adversarial process is the best way to get at the truth. That's the underlying premise of our entire court system. And yet you didn't have that with the January 6th committee. You had a completely united committee, all pushing the same narrative. In retrospect, was that a mistake?
No, absolutely not. I don't think it was a mistake. It was a product of the minority leader, Mr. McCarthy's decision to pull back the three nominees or the three people he put forth who were not material witnesses. So to go back to the premise of the question, there were two of the five names that McCarthy put forth who were directly involved in the issues that the committee was tasked with investigating. And you can't, it just wouldn't make sense as a matter of law to have people who were personally involved in also participating in the investigation. But the other three were accepted by the speaker, and McCarthy's decision to then say, no, we're not going to participate. We're going to paint this as a strictly partisan. I think that was a strategic mistake. And I contrast it with what the Democrats have done with the weaponization, you know, special committee in a Republican-led Congress to participate, even if they questioned the premise of the committee in the first place. I think that would have been wiser for Leader McCarthy. And then in terms of the way in which the adversarialness, I want to point out that all of the witnesses that we spoke to were very close to the former president, right? Were in his White House and in his family and in his administration. It was not like they were Democrats who were working with Democratic members of Congress and Liz Cheney to cook up some narrative, right? We were in the position of adversarialness to some extent every day when we were trying to extract information from reluctant witnesses who knew that what they were saying was going to negatively impact the person for whom they worked. So most of the questions that we had from key witnesses were kind of akin to cross-examination. Now, there were a lot of them that came forth and were willing to tell, you know, to talk about their experience. But again, they were all on the side of the other side politically from the chairman and the speaker and the people that formed the committee.
Yeah, but you had no cross-examination of the witnesses in which a minority member could poke holes or show contradictions. And as a result, you know, there was some testimony that has subsequently been challenged, particularly Cassidy Hutchinson and her testimony about Trump getting in the car with the Secret Service and, you know, going ballistic and grabbing the steering wheel. You know, that was refuted by other people who were there, yet it was put on by the committee, right, unchallenged, yep, by any member. You know, and it gave the critics of the committee some ammunition to say, look, you're just pushing a partisan narrative here.
Yeah, I totally understand. And had it been a fulsome majority and minority process, you know, perhaps it would have had more credibility. It did not evolve that way. Although we did have the two Republican members, they were aligned politically and on these issues with the Democratic members. So I take your point. All I can point to is the record and the aggressive posture in which we approached not only Ms. Hutchinson, but everybody in trying to do our own attempts to corroborate and fact check and ensure reliability of the testimony and the report. And I think ultimately this is a question for history, right? I feel good about what we put forth standing the test of time as the findings are scrutinized historically. Yeah.
Another criticism that has been out there is that the hearings were just a little too slick. You brought in the former head of ABC News, James Gulston, to basically produce the hearings. And as you yourself write, the hearings were carefully scripted with each word subject to factual review. The hearings were timed to the minute to accommodate the schedule dictated by television networks that showed them live. You know, a takeaway from that could be that this was a sort of slick TV infomercial political event rather than a robust hearing in which, you know, can often be chaotic, but, you know, does produce a clash that.
When I started working on the committee, I looked at the 9/11 Commission as kind of the gold standard for what these things should look like. I read the 9/11 Commission report and was envisioning that we would similarly, you know, have some hearings that would inform a sort of an ultimate written report. The members of the committee, the members of the select committee, my clients, I think wisely saw that America's kind of different now than it was 25 years ago and receives and processes information differently. And they made the decision that rather than just wait until the end to publish a written, you know, substantial volume, we need to tell the story in smaller chunks and we need to do it visually. I think the primary purpose of the select committee was one of public revelation and education as to what happened, right? This was not, we did have some proposals for legislative change and recommendations, but a big part of the mission of the committee was to tell the story. And we told the story in a way that met the audience where it is. It was scripted and it was carefully calibrated because I felt very strongly as the chief investigator that it needed to be unobjectionably correct, right? It needed to be, it would stand up to the scrutiny it would get. That was the reason for the scripting, not to fit it into some preconceived narrative, but to ensure that it had integrity, that every word we used was going to be something we could stand behind as a matter of fact. So it's different. I take your point that it could look like it was a slickly produced political presentation, but the goal was persuasion, was education. And I think it was effective in doing that. It got attention. I think they were persuasive. And again, look, historically, I think they're going to stand the test of time in terms of the reliability of the information.
There were so many powerful moments from those hearings. What stands out most to you? Or another way of asking is, what did you learn that surprised you the most?
I think the biggest surprise for me personally was how close this came to working, right? Like, I guess I kind of went into this thinking, you know, our democracy has these guardrails built in and the system is resistant to threats in a really sort of robust way over the course of our history. And while that's true, that's less so than I expected. And but for a handful of, I think, courageous people who were willing to kind of stand up and say, no, it could have worked. Like, it really could have, the peaceful transfer of power could have been prevented And that's frightening. It was closer, but for the sort of Mike Pence's.
How could it have worked? I mean, once Pence decided he wasn't going to do what Trump wanted him to do, which is reject some of the electoral votes. There weren't a majority in either the Senate or probably the House to overturn the results of the election.
Yeah. It was a political strategy, right? Like the idea was that, if Mike Pence were to reject certified electors from certain states and either throw it back to them or accept these alternate slates. But even assuming he did not, then it shifted to Congress objecting, delaying it, potentially having the Supreme Court kick it, get involved somehow if there's a logjam legislatively. Admittedly, long shot and unprecedented. But it was an intentional multi-part plan to try to delay, disrupt, and ultimately prevent the transfer of power. And again, it was thwarted by political leaders who stood up and said, nope, democracy, the rule of law does not facilitate that. And the last desperate step was the violence, right? People charging the Capitol to literally interrupt the joint session. And that was brave men and women in law enforcement who were put in a horrible position, who were able to repel that and get the session going again. So it held because of courageous people, and that's what it takes. And that, so the one of the lessons in my book, again, is that democracy really comes down to that. People exercising good faith, willing to do the right thing, even if it is not in their political or personal interest.
So as you no doubt saw a week or so ago, a House subcommittee headed by Congressman Loudermilk of Georgia has recommended that the Justice Department investigate members of the January 6th committee, in particular Liz Cheney, for improperly coercing or contacting a witness, Cassidy Hutchinson, when she had a lawyer. There were some other recommendations. But look, clearly there's a new crowd that's going to be taking over the Justice Department and the FBI who are going to be sympathetic to these arguments. Are you concerned that that the new Justice Department and FBI will in fact investigate members of the January 6th committee and perhaps yourself as well?
Not really. I got to say, I still think in this country it takes facts to create real culpability. I think we seem to be clearly headed for investigations. It doesn't take facts to investigate. So I wouldn't be surprised if congressional committees or even criminal grand juries start asking questions about the investigative work or go back to revisit the underlying issues surrounding the attack on the Capitol. That said, I'm not concerned that Ms. Cheney or anyone else has any real exposure. All she or we did was translate information that was provided to us by witnesses, by documents, and make them public, piece them together. But there is no, they were not, Ms. Cheney was not a firsthand witness to anything, and she did not tamper with any witness. She was, like all of us, given information that we then put forth in investigative findings. That's not criminal. And this narrative about destruction of information is also
What's that all
absurd.
About?
Completely absurd. Look, the House rules show that the official record of an interview is the transcript. So we did transcribed interviews and depositions, and every word of those preserved in the transcripts, and that is what was sent to the archives as the official records. The videotapes, which were supplemental records that were there to produce, potentially use in the hearings, are not the official records. So they were not archived. And a handful.
So it's just the videos. It's not the transcripts are all there, but not all the videos.
We did not, my understanding, and I was not involved in this, is that the sort of professional staff that adhered to the House rules and archiving everything decided that the videotapes were not official records, but the transcripts are. That's one of the allegations by the Loudermilk committee. The other is that there's some missing interviews, and that is because several White House staffers and Secret Service agents were only made available to the committee under the condition that we would not make their names public, we would not make the information public, because it would threaten national security if there was public information about White House operations. I believe that the Loudermilk Committee has actually gotten those transcripts and has had full access to them. So while they weren't published like the rest, they have been now made available. So again, nothing has been destroyed. Nothing has been hidden. There's no smoking gun that was not disclosed by the committee. That is not a basis, based on what I know, for any kind of criminal exposure or investigation. So bottom line, in answer to your question, they can ask a lot of questions, but there's just no there that would result in any culpability.
So got a final series of questions, more of a from a philosophical perspective. Like everybody else I know in Washington, I was glued to the hearings you put on in the summer of 2022. I mean, there were just amazing testimony firsthand from people inside the White House about Trump's, shocking refusal to lift a finger to stop the violence that was taking place at the Capitol. And yet, here we are in January 2025, about to see the inauguration of Donald Trump as president once again. Republican majorities in Congress, many of whom don't accept the findings of the January 6th committee. And the country, in a way, you could say, didn't either, because they elected the guy who you found primarily responsible for the events of January 6th. How do you explain that, and how does it make you feel?
So I reject the premise that people who voted for Trump reject the finding that he's responsible for January 6th. I think there are a fair amount of people.
If they accepted your findings that he incited an insurrection against the American government, it's hard to imagine how they could then vote for the guy.
No, it's not, Michael, because I think the fundamental dynamic that largely explains the president-elect's victory is that there are a lot of people in this country that don't believe in institutions, that don't believe in the efficacy of government, and want a candidate to lead the national government that they that will dismantle portions of it or will make it work in their view more for them. So you can't paint with a broad brush and say that's there's one factor that explains this. But when I look at Charlottesville January 6th, and I try to, in that lens, interpret these results, I think there are more people in this country, it's broader and deeper than I anticipated, that want a president who is going to dismantle what they perceive as a government that doesn't work for them, who will take on elites, who will drain the swamp, who will dismantle the deep state, right? That is a broader, more broadly supported perspective than I expect. So I think there are a lot of people that don't like the president's morals or think he did behave potentially even criminally with respect to January 6th, but they still want a change agent as president because they're so frustrated at the way that the system works or doesn't work for them. So that's kind of my 30,000 foot explanation for the election results. I wouldn't see it directly as a repudiation of the findings of the committee or having really anything to do with January 6th.
But is there something deeper in the American fabric about resistance to authority? And I was thinking about this a week or so ago when I went to see the terrific new movie, A Complete Unknown, about Bob Dylan. Yeah. And I don't know if you've had a chance to see it yet, but I strongly recommend it. But there's a scene, it's all about how Dylan goes electric at the Newport Folk Festival in 65. But a year before, he's singing The Times They Are A-Changing. Right. And, I don't know if you remember one of the stanzas. Come senators, congressmen, please heed the call. Don't stand in the doorway. Don't block up the hall. For he who that gets hurt will be he who has stalled. The battle outside is raging, will soon shake your windows and rattle your walls. The times they are a-changing.
Yeah.
You know, one could hear that and, you know, hear echoes of what happened on January 6th. Now, absolutely, of course, Dylan was, you know, most people were thinking at the time about the senators and congressmen who were blocking civil rights legislation for that was long overdue, a righteous and noble cause. But, you know, it is a reflection. But the people who were rioting on January 6th thought an election had been stolen.
Exactly.
Right. You know, so I'm just saying, you know, is there something in American culture, in our DNA, that does is sympathetic, if not celebratory, about resistance to authority?
Yeah. It's a good point and a good question. And I actually think that there's some foundation to this cynicism about the lack of efficacy of government. I write in the book that this problem that I define as the fundamental divide being between those who believe in institutions and those who don't, will not be solved top down by our elected officials. I have real concerns myself about the way in which our both federal and state legislatures work. They are drawn to be incumbent protection districts. The influx of money that primarily flows to incumbents discourage compromise and bring those people, those men and women, many of whom have good intentions, sort of prevents them from actually engaging, compromising, and solving the pressing issues of the day. So people see that and they get frustrated. And there's foundation for that. I don't mean to suggest that cynicism is misplaced. I think it actually has some basis in the distance that I am seeing between the what happens in Congress or what happens in Richmond, because I live in Virginia, and real people's issues and needs. So we gotta do something about this. That's broader than this president or any one elected official. It will be with us after he leaves and was with us before he got here. We also make a mistake if we ascribe too much of this to Donald Trump. I think he's recognized it and exacerbated it or exploited it, but he didn't create it. And it'll go on beyond him unless we address the underlying division.
Well, on that note, Tim Hafey, I want to thank you for joining us on Spy Talk. The book is Harbingers, and it's an important and very timely read. So
thank you for having me. It was a great conversation. And yes, thanks for your interest in the book, Michael. Okay. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. And that's it for this week's Spy Talk. Be sure to check out our complete podcast archive on Apple or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you haven't already, do check out the spytalk.co news site on Substack, where we offer a steady diet of scoops and original analyses on the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, and military operations. Just Google Spy Talk and you'll quickly find your way there. This edition of the Spy Talk podcast was smoothly produced, as always, by Kanai and expertly edited by Molly Hawkey for MSW Media. That's it. See you around. I'm Michael Isikoff. Thanks for listening.
For more original reporting and insights like this, subscribe to spytalk.co on Substack and follow us on Twitter at @talk_spy. If you enjoyed our podcast, subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MSW Media.
I'm Brian Karam, and I've spent decades covering politics. Now I'm taking you behind the scenes, one interview at a time.
Join us as each week Brian confronts the issues that matter, posing the questions you wish you could ask. No filter, no agenda, just the truth.
We're not here for sound bites. We're here for substance. Join me, Brian Karam, every week as we cut through the noise and get straight to it. This is Just Ask the Question, where curiosity will lead us to the facts.
Subscribe now on your favorite podcast platform, and remember, when you want answers, all you have to do is just ask the question.